Support for Here and Now comes from BetterHelp, committed to supporting mental health through therapy. Clients are matched with one of 25,000 therapists and can communicate via video, chat, or phone at betterhelp.com/public.
From NPR and WBUR, I'm Robin Young.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. It's Here and Now, and even as the number of cases and deaths from the coronavirus climbs, Wall Street appears to see a brighter future ahead economically, stocks jumping as the Senate heads toward a $2 trillion coronavirus relief deal. House Speaker Nancy Pelosi told CNBC this morning that Democrats pushed to focus the bill on workers and their paychecks.
We believe that this is not only good for the workers, the right thing for the country, but also good for the economy.
NPR congressional reporter Claudia Grisales joins us now. Claudia, what more do we know about this potential deal?
So the Senate lawmakers and White House officials have been working urgently over the last day. They think they're very close. They talk about the 5-yard line, now the 2-yard line in terms of announcing a deal. It would entail payments to Americans. That's what they're sorting out, is the specifics there, as well as additional aid for Americans and families and child care tax credits and a very significant lump sum that they would use to help some of these small businesses and large who are dealing with the fallout from this pandemic.
How did they get past the major sticking points that stalled the bill over the last couple of days, including what Democrats were calling a slush fund for the administration to dole out hundreds of billions of dollars?
Yes. So this slush fund was one area of focus for Democrats. Indeed, this is $500 billion they would direct in aid to these larger businesses, these industries that have been hard hit, such as airlines. And the concern there for Democrats is there wasn't enough oversight from outsiders, let's say a congressional panel or an inspector general. They thought that this money would just be doled out and it could go to CEO pay or even contribute to layoffs at some of these companies. And so that was one of their urgent concerns. They say that a lot of progress has been made there, and they've been assured so far that there would be a panel and an inspector general to oversee this $500 billion fund that could go to these larger businesses.
And what about to individuals, especially individuals who right now have lost their jobs or lost their income or their health care temporarily? How soon will relief come to people and businesses who don't have income because of COVID-19?
It's hard to say exactly when we could see this. They are moving quickly. This is what is driving them in terms of aiding these Americans, getting these payments out there. They're saying that they could reach a deal as soon as today. That means they could have a vote on this in the Senate tomorrow, and the House could handle this later this week. If they are moving on this clock that they hope to see, and the president could sign it into law, perhaps as early as this week. If that all stays on track, some are estimating that these payments could go out to Americans as early as next month. So those are the hopes. That's what everyone is aiming towards.
And just briefly, we heard about Senator Rand Paul, who's tested positive for COVID-19, and a couple of House members as well. Has anything changed on that front in the last 24 hours?
So they are still in quarantine. Rand Paul said he was asymptomatic. However, that's triggered on Sunday a 14-day quarantine for himself and for two Utah senators. Mitt Romney and Mike Lee are also quarantined because of their contact with Rand Paul, but they're basically all in a holding pattern, waiting to see this 14-day period work itself out so that it can return to the business of the Senate.
That is NPR congressional reporter Claudia Grisales. Claudia, thank you.
Thanks for having me.
And let's check in now on New Orleans. Governor John Bel Edwards says Louisiana has the third highest per capita rate of COVID-19 after New York and Washington State. We're joined now by Patrick Madden, news director for WWNO in New Orleans. Patrick, there are more than 1,000 cases in the state of Louisiana. How quickly has that number been rising?
Well, it's basically been skyrocketing here in Louisiana, and specifically in New Orleans. The caseload jumped up by 216, and there were additionally 12 more people have died. And so, you know, what we're really seeing here, whether you look at a per capita rate of infections or deaths, is that this area, New Orleans and then Louisiana, is really becoming one of the major hotspots for this epidemic. And yet it can sort of feel like, New Orleans is not getting perhaps as much attention as Washington State or New York City. And that matters when it comes to when resources are going to be directed by the federal government. But I think the real question, Jeremy, right now is, can hospitals here in New Orleans handle the expected surge of cases in the coming days? The governor just declared a state of emergency here. And in that letter, he said that the capacity for these hospitals will probably be exceeded on April 4th.
And just briefly, are people blaming Mardi Gras, all the people that were flocking to New Orleans for Mardi Gras?
You know, you're hearing that a lot. Yeah, other states were sort of the first ones when they were identifying COVID-19 cases were saying, well, this person had traveled to Louisiana around the time of Mardi Gras. So you're sort of hearing that perhaps, you know, Mardi Gras, when there, I think, an estimated 1 million people were, you know, watching the parades and floats and partying on the streets. And if there was coronavirus, you know, that would be, you know, a disaster if that was helping spread the disease or virus.
Patrick Madden with WWNO in New Orleans. Thank you.
Thank you, Jeremy.
Well, every now and then you come across something on Twitter that gives you pause. For me recently, it was Bob Hayes tweeting, "My 96-year-old mom tested positive for COVID-19. She's got a cough and a slight fever. Her nursing home is under quarantine. We can now only see her through her outside window. A request. She loves cats. Please send cute cat pics and I'll print and paste them to her window. Thanks." Well, people sent pictures of their cats in nurses' caps, cats in scrubs. Seattle resident Bob Hayes and his mom, Tomoko, are not alone. CNBC is reporting that 147 nursing homes in 27 states have at least one resident with COVID-19, despite rules barring visitors. What must that be like? Well, let's ask. Bob Hayes is director of research and analytics at the consulting firm Indigo Slate in Seattle. More important, the son of Tomoko Hayes. Bob, how's your mom doing?
She's doing well, actually. I just got an update yesterday from my brother, my twin brother, and her fever is down to 99, and they're kind of concerned about her not drinking and eating, but other than that, she's pretty stable.
Well, that is great to hear. And how did people respond to your request?
Oh, my God. I'm overwhelmed. I sent the tweet out on Saturday evening, and within the next, like, hour or two, I had hundreds, and then overnight, it just kept growing and growing, and I'm seriously overwhelmed. I can't see all these cat pictures. I think I had over 50,000 people send me pictures, and some of them sent me more than one. So I have like 100,000 pictures I have to sift through. It's beautiful.
Well, yeah, it was. And when you come across the one of the big fat calico on her back, that's mine. Mm-hmm. How is she responding to them?
She has dementia, so you know, she looks at them and smiles, and she has some baby dolls with her.
Dementia and COVID-19 and separated from her family by a window. We've been seeing heartbreaking pictures of, you know, elderly grandparents seeing a granddaughter's engagement ring through a nursing home window, a man seeing his great-grandchild through the nursing home window. This has got to be tough.
It's sad because it's hard not to hug your loved ones. And I miss my whole family, actually. We were on a Zoom call the other night. I just miss hugging them and being with them.
Yeah.
Especially my mom in the time of need.
Well, in the time of need, 96. Do you know, by the way, how she contracted the COVID-19?
So I know her friends had it, were diagnosed like a week or two before that. And so they were just waiting to see. Then they thought, well, it should just test all the residents.
Well, and there you are in the Seattle area. We're well aware of the Kirkland, Washington Life Care Center nursing home where this terrible outbreak really exploded. Dozens of the nursing home residents there have died. So, you know, the toughest question of all, and I want to be tender about this, but are you contemplating that you may not be able to be by her side should that happen?
Yeah, I've been thinking about that. With that alone, it's sad. But one thing I'm content with is that she lived a long life. You know, she has awesome kids, awesome grandkids, great-grandkids. So she's made a mark on the world. So if she has to go, I understand. It'll suck, but she had a good run, as my friends would say.
How are you handling it? Because thousands of people in this country are, and we know outside of the Life Care Center, the adult children of these patients were outraged and, you know, holding up protest signs that they couldn't go in. You know, thousands of people are having to adjust that they can't go in.
Right.
Is there something you might do by the window? How have you thought about that?
Well, the family members are taking shifts as we visit her. We stay far apart and we stand there and we talk to her for a spell.
through the window.
Yeah, exactly through the window. You know, we yell at the window, and you know, we have a good time. We say hi, and we laugh, and we make the best of it.
Well, and you have cat pictures.
And yes, and we have hundreds and thousands of cat pictures.
I'm thinking if your mom doesn't see them, you and your family members.
Oh, it's true. I'm so overwhelmed that I've asked my grandnephew and niece to look through them and pick the favorite ones, and those are the ones I'll print out because, again, I can't withdraw all of them.
Yeah, but you know what? We're going to tell people to keep sending them. How about that?
Please do. It cheers me up. All the well wishes. I'm overwhelmed. I get choked up sometimes when I read them. They're beautiful. Yeah. Hashtag Tomoko's cats.
We wish you, Bob Hayes, and your mom Tomoko, all the best as you try to make the best of this terrible situation, and in so doing, give an example to all of us. Thank you.
Thank you.
Can't imagine it, separated from your mom by a window. We'll link you to Bob's Twitter account and some adorable pictures at hereandnow.org.
This message comes from Here and Now sponsor, Indeed. When it comes to hiring, you don't have time to waste. You need help getting to your short list of qualified candidates fast. That's why you need Indeed.com. Post a job in minutes, set up screener questions, then zero in on qualified candidates using an intuitive online dashboard. And when you need to hire fast, accelerate your results with sponsored jobs. New users can try for free at Indeed.com/here now. Terms, conditions, and quality standards apply. Offer valid through March 31st, 2020.
We know the coronavirus can hit anyone, but it's had the biggest impact on the elderly. So not surprising, the outbreak is dramatically hitting Meals on Wheels, the venerable food service program for the vulnerable, delivering meals to more than 2 million people across the country, including many for whom it is the only meal of the day. Meals on Wheels America President and CEO Ellie Hollander is here. Ellie, so many things to think about here. You know, more people over 60 are staying home because they're being told to, so you may feel more need soon. But how are you delivering to the elderly when this is the population that's supposed to isolate?
Hi, Robin. Thanks for the opportunity. Well, Meals on Wheels programs, as you know, are designed to focus on this highly vulnerable population on a good day. So in light of the pandemic, they are pivoting very quickly to anticipate and scale to many more seniors needing meals at home. Previously, many programs had senior centers, cafes, community dining facilities where seniors would go not only for a nutritious meal, but also for really important socialization and exercise, education. And those have now been sort of transformed into grab-and-go or takeout-type locations. Mm-hmm. We are definitely seeing an increased demand for home-delivered meals.
Well, you know, you do different things. You deliver to people at home, but you also have these senior centers that you bring congregate meals to. They're closed, many of the senior centers. So you're saying there's more of a takeout drive-through style now.
Exactly. They're trying to mobilize those locations for seniors that are able to get out or for loved ones who are able to drive to pick up maybe a pack of meals so that, frozen or shelf stable, so that seniors can stay in their own homes longer, which is what we're all supposed to be doing if we're 60 and over.
Yeah, yeah. Well, and your volunteers, we asked how, you know, what do you do with people at home who may not want to come out because they want to isolate? So many of your volunteers are just knocking on the people's doors, putting the food down and leaving. But some people can't come get it, I'm assuming.
Right. So we do have a no-touch approach to be consistent with CDC and local health officials' guidelines that our staff and volunteers who are still able are coming to the home, letting the senior know ahead of time or knocking very loudly. They're used to having us come, so they're waiting for us. And then stepping back, putting the meal there, and still having, to the extent that we can, a conversation from afar, 6 feet or greater, to make sure that the Meals on Wheels deliverer and the client are safe. Mm. You're right that, Robin, in some cases, we do have some seniors who require us to cross the threshold into the home. So we're being very careful about that, practicing all the appropriate protocols to make sure that we're not not touching anyone, but that we are, if it's extenuating circumstances, making sure that that senior is getting a meal and someone to check in on them.
Yeah, and many of your volunteers are also over 60 years of age, so some of them might be concerned about their own health. But I know you're also concerned about funding. You've been working with lawmakers. How is the emergency funding? Some of that is going to go to your program.
That's right. So just last week, the president signed into law the first, I'm not going to get it right, so I'm just going to say a coronavirus emergency fund that provides $250 million for senior nutrition programs, including home-delivered meals. This emergency will enable, this emergency supplemental funding will enable us to provide millions more meals over the next couple of months in anticipation of increased demand. It's a Families First Coronavirus Response Fund. There you go.
Right. And in just a minute and a half, we have left. Most of your food we know comes from caterers and restaurants. Are you still going to be able to get that?
Yeah, I think that there's incredible concern about we're all going to the same food sources for the ingredients that we need for our meals. So far, so good, but I think we're anticipating that as demand increases, it's going to be a bit of a challenge. So we're making sure that Meals on Wheels programs and the food producers that we rely on are identified as essential services so they can continue to operate during this pandemic.
Yeah. And look, as we said, you know, this is sometimes the only meal that some of your clients receive. It is incredibly important. It's great that you're going to get some of the emergency funding that's coming out of Washington, but you've also set up a Meals on Wheels COVID-19 Response Fund. People can help, and just briefly, help's needed.
It absolutely is. We would encourage anyone who has discretionary income in light of the market and everything else to give what they can. This will help us with direct local response as well as continuing our nationwide response, doing a twofold full court press. So we encourage people to get on the website and donate if they can.
We'll link you up at hereandnow.org. Meals on Wheels President and CEO Ellie Hollander, thanks, and thanks for your good work. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Robin.
Well, if you have any pending medical appointments, chances are you've recently received a voicemail like this one.
As a precautionary measure, we're going to change your appointment from an in-person visit to a telephone visit.
Well, whether by phone or video or online chat, so-called telemedicine is exploding as a result of the coronavirus outbreak. Carrie Goldberg of member station WBUR reports that the shift to virtual visits was slow in coming until now.
Nearly 20 years ago, Dr. Lee Schwamm helped pioneer what was called telestroke treatment, connecting stroke specialists by video link with remote doctors who needed an urgent consultation about a patient. It showed telemedicine could be helpful and easy to use, even back then, before everyone was using FaceTime and Skype. But there was no instant tele-revolution, Schwamm says.
I think spreading beyond those niche areas, there have been several really important barriers. The first one is that the laws that regulate the practice of medicine are quite arcane.
There were privacy concerns. There was resistance from insurance companies who saw so-called virtual visits as similar to phone calls, which they do not reimburse for.
All those concerns have evaporated in the face of a crisis where everyone is now scrambling to try to keep doctors and patients separate but still provide care, and quell a large tide of rising anxiety among the public.
Dr. Schwamm is a neurologist and the vice president in charge of virtual care for Partners Healthcare, the largest hospital chain in Massachusetts. That means he's working 16-hour days right now to shift as many healthcare staffers as possible toward virtual care, including video visits and chatbots. He says about 400 or so had been very actively using video visits.
Our job now is to turn that virtual visit program on for 11,000 providers as fast as we can.
It's a shift happening across healthcare as clinics and hospitals try to protect patients and keep staffers from becoming infected with the coronavirus. And telemedicine is getting a major boost from government action, including $500 million for telehealth expansion in a new law signed by President Trump and a lifting of telehealth restrictions for seniors on Medicare. Some states are also ordering private insurers to cover virtual visits the same way they cover in-person visits. Dr. Joseph Kavidar is the president-elect of the American Telemedicine Association.
The interest and adoption of telehealth across the nation in the last week has really been unprecedented.
He says there are three big challenges that many doctors, especially those in small practices, are facing.
The right software that's secure, the right integration with their electronic records, and billing insurance. But these things are all happening as well.
I push this button to trigger the video.
At the operations center of the Atrius Health Medical Network in Boston, Dr. Phil Ciampa is holding a staff training on how to do a virtual visit with a possible coronavirus patient. He's talking to a mock patient who's had fever and chills for a day or so. The video allows a visual exam.
I can tell that your respiratory rate is normal right now, and I can also tell that you're not using any accessory muscles to breathe and that your breath is comfortable.
The patient can be asked to tap out their pulse rate and to take their own blood pressure and temperature if they have the tools, he explains. So medical professionals can monitor the vital signs that they normally check during an office visit from afar. Ciampa is the chief innovation engineer for Atrius Health and has been working to scale up virtual visits since 2016.
In the last 4 weeks, we've accomplished more than we have in the last 4 years on this topic.
At Atrius, virtual care is being used to triage patients concerned about possible coronavirus. And Ciampa says it's also being ramped up for non-coronavirus concerns to let other patients avoid office visits as well. At Partners Hospitals, Dr. Lee Schwamm says virtual care also includes iPads mounted on IV poles near inpatients who may have the coronavirus. That lets nurses communicate with them without having to risk infection by going into the room. And work is underway on a chatbot to help patients figure out if they may have the virus and what to do next.
We're getting swamped by requests for advice and help, which is totally understandable.
And which technology can help alleviate, he says. So when the coronavirus outbreak is over, how much of this virtual care will remain? Dr. Kvitar from the American Telemedicine Association says face-to-face visits won't go away. They can be uniquely valuable.
What I speculate on is after the dust settles, and we know it will patients want to go back? Will they sort of say, hey, you know, I had that. I don't know why we can't keep doing it that way.
Ultimately, Kvitar says, virtual visits should simply be part of routine care. And over the weekend, President Trump said that patients using telemedicine are loving it. For Here and Now, I'm Carrie Goldberg.
Need to escape the news for a moment?
Check out Endless Thread, a podcast from WBUR and Reddit.
From mysteries to histories to stories that will remind you of our shared humanity.
Subscribe to Endless Thread on Apple Podcasts or wherever you listen.
Warehouse workers are calling on Amazon to do more to stop the spread of the coronavirus as the company sees a surge in delivery orders from customers in self-isolation. For more, we're joined by Elizabeth Dwoskin, Silicon Valley correspondent for The Washington Post. And Elizabeth, Amazon says it's following proper health protocols, but there have been COVID-19 cases confirmed at their warehouses in New York, Italy, and Spain. What are Amazon workers saying they want the company to do?
Well, some of them are saying in the warehouses where there have been confirmed cases are saying everyone should be sent home because everyone potentially had contact with those two workers, or at least those people who worked on the shift with those two workers. So the workers are just extremely anxious. I mean, imagine if you were going into work every day in a work environment where you knew one of your colleagues tested positive and you had interaction with them. And,
right,
you know, it's still hard to get tests. You'd be totally freaked out, and they are as well. And, you know, the company is saying they're practicing social distancing, but we're hearing from workers that they're only really about 3 feet apart in some of the warehouses, which is not the protocol for social distancing. And they don't have masks right now. Some of the warehouses don't have sanitizer in the U.S. So, you know, for those of you relying on Amazon packages, I'm keeping mine in quarantine for 24 hours before I open them.
Well, and a lot of people are relying on Amazon right now because they're stuck at home and they think to themselves, hey, maybe I'll just order it on Amazon. Then I don't even have to leave my home. How much more demand is Amazon seeing because of the pandemic?
Well, the way that my colleague Jay Green described it to me, it's like every day is Black Friday. But
wow,
if you think about Black Friday, these are events that companies like Amazon prepare for months. And I think Jeff Bezos said this weekend, by the way, I should disclose, he owns the Washington Post. I don't think he's been involved in any of our protocols, and we're all working from home, which is unprecedented for the newsroom. But he said in his letter on Saturday to employees that they're actually trying to hire 100,000 more people. And he said, if you've been laid off, come work for Amazon.
Meanwhile, there are a lot of small businesses that obviously don't have the power of Amazon to ramp up in a situation like this and start delivering everything. Do you think that this moment could just cement Amazon's dominance in e-commerce?
Yeah, I think that there's a lot of conversation about just how, in general, the larger platforms will emerge as dominant players kind of after this era of coronavirus or whatever comes next. It's not that people aren't going to the stores, you know, in grocery stores around here in the Bay Area, like there's lines around the block. But in terms of online shopping, I think a lot of people are doing online grocery shopping for the first time. And then, of course, you have like the Zoom conferences of the world and the WebExes, Facebook, YouTube. I mean, they've all seen such huge surges in traffic just from people being stuck at home and trying to depend on remote technologies. You're seeing these shifts in American behavior that once sort of people cross the Rubicon, then it's like maybe they won't go back to the way things were before.
Right. Which, of course, would be very sad when it comes to all the small businesses that we love so much now, and they're not able to compete in this way at this moment, at least so far, against giants like Amazon. That is Elizabeth Dwoskin, Silicon Valley correspondent for The Washington Post. Thank you.
Thanks for having me.
Perhaps you're looking for something to pass your self-quarantine time. How about a Jesse Eisenberg double feature, and you don't even have to go out? The actor has two films coming out Friday on digital and video on demand. In The Lovely Resistance, Eisenberg plays the great French mime Marcel Marceau. As a young man during World War II, a member of the French Resistance who used his skills and imagination to rescue hundreds of Jewish children orphaned by the Nazis. True story. In this scene, he teaches a group of children how to hide.
Now, have you seen a squirrel hide? A squirrel. The squirrel does not find a place to hide in the tree.
No. The squirrel finds a place to hide
where she can become a part of the tree.
And then there is Jesse Eisenberg's other film, Vivarium. Yikes. Jesse and Imogen Poots play Tom and Gemma, an increasingly uncomfortable house-hunting couple, shown a home in a neighborhood where all the homes look just the same, little green boxes. And then there's that realtor, Martin, played by Jonathan Aris.
The living room. A room to live in. Memories will be made in the ample spaces between these walls.
Good. It's good. I love it. I love the single hue.
Oh, they're laughing now, but soon they're trapped inside that home with a child, not theirs. Someone who's increasingly, what, feral? Did we mention Vivarium means animal enclosure? Maybe just what you need in this time of self-quarantine, someone who's worse off than you are. Again, Resistance and Vivarium are out on digital and video on demand this Friday. And Jesse Eisenberg joins us now by Skype. Jesse, you know how weird Vivarium is.
Yeah, I mean, it's like really a kind of a fever dream of a movie where, you know, these characters that are wanting to do kind of all the normal modern middle class things, buy a house, get married, have a child, you know, and live in the suburbs, wind up in the kind of worst nightmare version of all of this stuff. And, you know, it's funny because we were making the movie at a time of, you know, at a time really any other time than this. And just thinking of it as this kind of nightmarish fever dream. But of course, it has some very strange resonance right now where this kind of insidious thing seems to be attacking you and you're stuck inside your house and, you know, and there's no one around. And so, yeah, the movie just, well, you know, as movies often do, take on different resonance when they finally come out.
Well, as I said, it's either going to be exactly what people need to really get into the feelings that they're having of not getting out of the house and decomposing, you know, their hair and their clothes. Or is it your worst nightmare that people might say, the last thing I want to see is people trapped in a house?
Well, you know, obviously it depends on their particular situations. If you have a kind of a case of Schadenfreude, you probably would enjoy watching somebody, as you said, who's worse off than you. But if you you know, want to get your mind off it, I'm sure there's a million other you know, things on your queue.
Yeah. Well, but I want to pay a compliment because someone said to me, oh, it's a horror film, and they know that I'm not really drawn to horror films, but I didn't see it as a horror film. I saw it more as a Twilight Zone.
Yeah, that's what I call it. I call it kind of more like a cross between Louis Buñuel and, you know, and Black Mirror or Twilight Zone kind of thing, where it takes like these kind of real world symbols but skews them in a way to create this kind of terror in the characters. But it's not in any way kind of a traditional horror movie with scares and stuff like that.
No, it's like The Truman Show, only really, really, really dark.
Yeah, exactly.
And then there's Resistance. Now, this tells about a chapter in the life of the great French mime Marcel Marceau. We read you're the grandchild of Holocaust survivors. That's the springboard for this story. You know, in the beginning, we see Kristallnacht and a family dragged off, horrifying. Mm-hmm. Did that have something to do with your decision to make this film? Or?
Yeah, I mean, there were so many unusual coincidences between, you know, this movie and my life. My mother is a birthday party clown. So growing up, my mother put on basically the same makeup as Marceau and performed for children in the way that he is performing, of course, in different circumstances, obviously. And coincidentally, my family is from very close to where Marceau's family comes from in southern Poland. And then what I really love most about the story is that it's really about this artist who was kind of a reluctant hero because he prizes his art so specifically. He thinks of himself as this pure artist and that art should only be done for its own sake. And then as the war kind of heats up and he's asked to come and entertain kids initially, he realizes that he can kind of use his art for the benefit of others. And so he kind of becomes like a hero reluctantly.
Well, it makes you love Marcel Marceau even more if you know him.
Yeah.
But I want to hold that thought for a second because, hold on, your mother was a birthday party clown?
Yeah.
Is that, I mean, clowns to some people are scary. I mean, what was that like to see mom, you know, transform and go off? Are you seeing a therapist or was that a good thing?
Well, I'm yes, but for other reasons. But my mom was a clown. My dad taught social psychology. And so she kind of was able to, I guess, with his help, tap into what scared kids and avoid those things. So, for example, big shoes scared kids because they're at shoe level. They're small. And those are scary. The fake like nose, that's scary to kids. So I guess with my dad's expertise in groupthink and my mom's ability to entertain, they created kind of a clown that was not scary. And then in terms of like its impact on me, you know, every weekend growing up, I would wake up to the sound of my mom tuning her guitar. And even though she was performing this kind of very silly performance, you know, she took it so seriously. You know, I'd wake up to her meticulously tuning a guitar. And so I think in some way it unconsciously at least taught me that regardless of what kind of performance you're doing, take it seriously. Mm-hmm. And, you know, if it's a kind of silly comedy movie or whatever, you take it as seriously as you would take any drama.
That's so fascinating. And so here you are playing Marcel Marceau. Some of us can conjure up the image of the man who often wore the sort of the white bodysuit with maybe the buttons on it and used his hands to indicate that he was in a box that he couldn't get out of, even though there was nothing there. You now have to have that same physicality. And you do. I mean, is that something? Did you have to take lessons for that, movement lessons? How did you come to that?
Yeah, I mean, I studied mime for about 9 months with this wonderful teacher, Lauren Eric Somm. And he's just a fantastic teacher, but not only a fantastic teacher and disciple of Marceau, but also a kind of chronicler of Marcel Marceau's life and of mime in general and the history of mime. And so I had this unbelievable, lengthy 9-month lesson, not only in my routines that I had to learn from the movie, which were choreographed by Lauren, but also I learned the history of mime and got to appreciate the ideas of, you know, this kind of more abstract performance that is, you know, it's not the kind of literal performances that I'm used to either writing or acting in.
Yeah. So two films, one terrifying, and that's Vivarium. One also terrifying, but very sweet, a true story of the chapter of Marcel Marceau's life told in Resistance. Woohoo! You've got two movies coming out. And no one going to movie theaters, and you can't fly on airplanes to promote it. And so what do you do with that?
It's so surreal. I mean, and I don't have a sense of if people are kind of wanting to watch movies. It feels kind of strange to talk about it. You know, it feels kind of like, oh, talking about something petty in the context of something much bigger. And especially if, like, you know, I'm in the kind of like public conversation once every, you know, year and a half when I have movies come out and I have to do interviews. And so, like, you know, you don't want to be during the time where you feel like kind of irresponsible talking about anything other than washing your hands. And so it's a little strange, but people at some point are going to, you know, I imagine want to engage in some kind of normal activity, even if you're doing it from your couch rather than in a movie theater. And these movies, as you kind of emphasized, have kind of very different approaches to entertainment at this particular moment. You know, one is kind of emphasizing the horrors of this surreal suburban world, and the other one is kind of an uplifting movie of heroism during the war, both not blind to the terrors of the world. And I imagine people want to engage in some kind of, I don't know, normal activity. It seems inevitable. That seems to be the default, isn't it?
Well, Jesse, I also think, well, you could just make believe, you know, oh, okay, nobody's going to go see my movies. I'm going to go write and I think they will see your movies. But you've written four plays, short stories. Do you find yourself thinking, or maybe fellow writers thinking, pandemic and presidential election, that's taken? I have to.
Yes. Yeah. I mean, that's, you know, it's so funny, you know, when the world is all thinking about one thing, you know, like, when you're thinking about writing something, you're like, oh, yeah, there's no original thought that I can have about it that hasn't already been thought of by somebody more talented. And so, yeah. And also, what is my take on it that differs from, so, yeah. So unfortunately, in this kind of a moment where everybody is thinking the same thing, it puts a little damper on your own originality.
Right. Well, Jesse Eisenberg, again, the two new films, Resistance and Vivarium, both coming out on digital and video on demand Friday. Jesse, thanks so much and best to you.
Thank you so much for doing this. And yeah, and stay safe. Thank you.
Well, and while a pandemic and a presidential campaign has already been taken, Jesse Eisenberg has been writing. His piece, An Immodest Proposal, performed by actor Richard Kind, is part of the 24-hour Plays Viral Monologues. We'll link you up, hereandnow.org.
And as countries around the world tackle coronavirus, we're going to spend a few minutes now talking about what's working. Cases have declined in Hubei province, China, where the pandemic originated. Chinese authorities now say that they will lift a lockdown on most of the region and loosen some restrictions in Wuhan. The World Health Organization has also praised the efforts of some of China's neighbors. Here's WHO head of emergencies Mike Ryan at a press conference yesterday.
We've seen examples in places like Singapore and Korea where governments haven't had to shut everything down. They've been able to make tactical decisions regarding schools, tactical decisions regarding movements, and been able to move forward without some of the draconian measures.
Joining us now is NPR's Global Health and Development correspondent Jason Beaubien. Jason, you were in Hong Kong last month. It is obviously right next to mainland China, but just a few hundred cases total. How did Hong Kong have such success in addressing this crisis?
By doing it very aggressively, testing extensively, using travel restrictions, using quarantines, but jumping on this very early. On December 31st of 2019, Hong Kong sent out a memo to all of its doctors at its hospitals telling them to be on the lookout for patients with fever and acute respiratory illness or pneumonia, shortness of breath, and particularly anyone at that point with travel to Wuhan. But probably most important than any other factor was that if someone tests positive in Hong Kong, the health authorities chase down every single close contact that they can find, and they put them into 14 days of quarantine. They publicize each case. They call on people who may have had contact with, say, this particular taxi driver or this shop clerk or this Buddhist temple. Come forward, get screened. At one point in February, they had 12,000 people in quarantine, despite only reporting a couple of new cases every day. And by doing this, Hong Kong sort of built this protective ring around each case and didn't get much onward transmission.
Although there is worry that they may have let down the guard too soon because they have just tightened measures again, right?
That's right. They have seen a surge in cases recently, but it's, and they basically anyone who's coming in at the moment is going to go into 14 days of quarantine or they're just barred from coming in. So they really have sort of locked things down just recently. They also blocked the sale of alcohol in bars and restaurants, saying that they don't want people to be losing their inhibition and doing things that they shouldn't. But it's important to point out that this recent surge of cases in Hong Kong has not been from community spread. The recent surge has primarily been among travelers, mostly coming from Europe, coming back into Hong Kong.
Hmm. Which is something similar we're hearing in China, that the new cases end up being people coming in from the outside, not community spread. What about South Korea, which has gotten so many accolades from global health officials? They've been able to keep businesses open in many cases. What explains their success?
You know, it's interesting. Similar techniques in Hong Kong and Singapore to what's going on in South Korea. We should note, however, that South Korea does have more than 9,000 cases, so that fairly large outbreak there, but very aggressive in tracking cases, isolating contacts. They also have been using big data. They've been tracking people's cell phones and credit card purchases to see who they came in contact with. They've been using surveillance camera data to see where people are moving. You know, some of these techniques would certainly raise eyebrows and concerns among civil libertarians in the U.S. However, this has sort of been the trade-off, right? Their restaurants, their factories, they're still open. In Singapore, the schools are even have stayed open. And one other thing that links these three countries together, Hong Kong, Singapore, and South Korea, is that they've all dealt with coronavirus outbreaks in the past. Hong Kong and Singapore, it was SARS in 2003. South Korea, it was MERS in 2015. So they were aware of how bad these things could be.
And what about Japan? We heard today from the International Olympic Committee that the Tokyo Summer Olympics are being postponed for a year. This is a reversal from what the Japanese government had been insisting for weeks about the games. How has Japan done in dealing with coronavirus?
So Japan is interesting. They have just over 1,000 cases. And again, you know, that's relatively low to many of the European countries. Definitely, I mean, New York is above 20,000 at this point, just for New York. So, you know, Japan has managed to keep, as they say, the curve flat. They got a lot of cases in February around that same time as the Diamond Princess cruise ship was quarantined in Yokohama. There were some people who were working on that quarantine that ended up in sort of seeding some clusters in Japan. But, you know, they haven't done as much testing as Hong Kong or South Korea, but they have aggressively gone after clusters whenever they've gotten them.
You know, it sounds, Jason, like the answer in all three cases is data, testing, data, know the information, and that helps.
Absolutely. And, you know, I think that some people might look at it and go, we can't in the United States do what they have done in these other Asian countries. But there are states in the United States that are in that position that still have low numbers of cases and still at this point are starting to get the testing so that they can get that data and do this similar model to what's happened over there.
That is NPR health correspondent Jason Bobie. And Jason, thank you.
You're welcome.
And Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Robin Young. This is Here and Now.